So, some of you may have heard this before, but I saw a documentary once on Moses, and there is a monastery in the area where Moses walked near Mount Sinai, where, no, Horeb, where they believe they have the actual original burning bush that Moses saw. And what's so funny about this is that at one point, several hundred years ago, it's growing up through the middle of this building. They built, like a shrine around it, and that turned into a building. Now the building is several stories high because the bush has gotten bigger and bigger. And so it's sort of like in an inner courtyard exposed to the outdoors with this building around it. Well, several hundred years ago, that bush actually caught on fire. It actually caught on fire and it almost died. Like a large portion of it, a large portion of it was destroyed. And it took a lot of nurturing and a lot of heavy-duty TLC to get this bush growing and thriving again. So at this point, because it's such a large tourist attraction, people come from all around the world to see the actual bush that burned and that originally called Moses to lead the Hebrews out of Egypt. At this point, they're so afraid of losing that bush to fire again that it's surrounded by fire extinguishers on all levels of the building, as required by insurance. Because God forbid, right? God forbid the burning bush catch on fire again and it stop being a tourist attraction. It is now protected by insurance-regulated fire extinguishers on all levels. This is how easy it is. This is how easy it is to forget what God's call is supposed to be about. This is how easy it is for us to lose sight of the difference between saying we're a believer and acting like a believer. Years ago, I was working, volunteering at a rotating shelter that the churches in Eugene, Oregon did during the winter months. 2 weeks, each church would take 2 weeks, and families with children would be able to stay there in individual rooms for 2 weeks, and then during the day they could go to work or they could go get services or whatever they needed. And my schedule was really packed, so I wasn't able to be there during the day. But they needed someone to stay overnight and just sort of be there in case there's an emergency, field the phone calls if anything comes in. And so my first night ever doing this, I think I was 19, we got a call late at night. It was about 10 o'clock. Dinner was over. They'd cleaned up. Everybody was in bed. And we got a call late at night saying, there's a couple coming. There's a couple coming. Late night, they're going to need room. And this couple showed up, and the woman was pregnant. It was 2 weeks before Christmas. She's pregnant like this. She and her husband had come out on promise of a job. I can't tell you how many people come to California seeking a better life on promise of a job, only to have it evaporate after they've spent their life savings getting out here. And so they found themselves homeless. And they were wandering around. And what was extraordinary was they said that for 2 weeks they had been trying to find shelter. They didn't know about this rotating shelter that we had until that night. Because what they had been doing is literally knocking on doors, asking if they could have shelter for the night. And most people said no. Most people said no. Some people said, go to the shelter, like go to the homeless shelters that were established in town. But the homeless shelters wanted to break them up. They wanted to put the men in one shelter on one side of town and the women in a different shelter on the other side of town. And he was unwilling to leave his wife when she was 8.5 months pregnant. So they went and they knocked on doors. And what they told me that night is she was having 7-Up to settle her stomach. She was still having morning sickness that late in pregnancy. They said that, when they knocked on the doors, so many people said no. But it was the Christians who took them in. The Christians who knew about this rotating shelter and the Christians that got them hooked up with the services that were going to allow them to figure out what they were going to do next and have some resources to get home or to find a job. But I don't think, when they told me that, I thought, oh, isn't that wonderful? Can't we just pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, all the Christians helped these poor people? I bet there are a lot of people that they knocked on those doors who said that they were Christians, who told themselves they were Christians, but didn't actually help. They probably just didn't reveal that to the couple. So in this story of Moses and the burning bush, two big questions come to mind. Lots of big questions come to mind. How did the bush burn but not be consumed is a big one. Scholars have been arguing that for thousands of years. But why did God choose Moses? Of all the people God could have chosen, why did God choose Moses? Why does God call any of the people that stand out in history as great freedom fighters, as great liberators, as great prophets? And why did Moses say no? Did you hear him say no? He didn't say it directly, because, you know, he was talking to God. But he said, why me? Why me? Of all the people you could choose, why me? I think you might be better off finding someone else. So there was one time when I was in Campbell, working in a church in Campbell. And same thing happened. It was the middle of summer, and a couple called me. Same story. They'd come out on a bus on promise of a job. The job had evaporated in the 4 days it took them to get out from Texas on the Greyhound. And they suddenly found themselves with no shelter. And they had been out of doors for 3 days. And I kid you not, the man's name was Joe. And the woman's name was Maria. And she was pregnant. And they had called the shelters, and the shelters were full. And they had started calling churches, and they told me, and I can't tell you how many times, I don't know, maybe there was a list somewhere in that town that said, here's all the churches in alphabetical order, and UCC is on the bottom because we're a U. Because so many times people would say, we called 17 churches before we got to you, and they all told us no. They all told us, go someplace else. They all told us, go to the shelters. But the same situation, they would have separated the men from the women, or the shelters were completely full. So I put them up in a hotel overnight and brought them some food from our food pantry and went to the local burrito place that served really good burritos, and he gave me free burritos to take to them so they would have a hot, nutritious meal. 17 churches said no. 17. All the shelters said, we're too full, before they got to us. That has happened so many times, I can't even tell you. So when we look at Moses in this story, there's a backstory. We are starting with the burning bush, but do you remember how Moses was in a time when Pharaoh had decided that the Israelites were a threat? And so he decided to oppress them, and that didn't work. So he called on the midwives to kill the little baby boys. Remember that? And they wouldn't do it. And so then he decided to enslave the people. And it was somewhere around that time that Moses was born. And his mother realized she couldn't keep him hidden anymore. So she put him in a basket and sent him down the river. And Pharaoh's own daughter, found him and fished him out. That all happened long before this. So Moses grew up in the Pharaoh's household. And this is really important. Even though he grew up in the Pharaoh's household and was very, very privileged, can you imagine growing up in Pharaoh's household? Being brought up and raised by Pharaoh's own daughter, that had to be some enormous wealth, some enormous privilege, some enormous luxuries, safety, education, luxurious foods, fine silks. And at the same time, we can't forget that in growing up in this household, Moses would have been exposed to certain ideologies. Because by this point, Pharaoh had already established an us versus them philosophy. There's us, the good Egyptians, and then there's those, the Israelites, who threaten us. There was already that us versus them. And by the time Moses was born, it had turned into not just us versus them polarization, but dehumanization. They were no longer the Israelite people, which is a nation with a name. They were the Hebrews. And scholars believe that Habiru, the word we get Hebrew from, Habiru meant refugee. That's what it meant. They think that the word Hebrew came from that ancient word Habiru, and it was not a pleasant word. It is not the kind of word you would use in polite company to describe refugees. I'm sure we can all think of slurs that we have heard that would be equivalent to Hebrew and Habiru and how those words were used. And Pharaoh grew up in this household where or Moses grew up in this household where Pharaoh was constantly talking about this and trying to figure out how to deal with that problematic nuisance of a people that he referred to as the Hebrews. By the time Moses grew up, he was referring to them as lazy and worthless slaves. This cannot be discounted. Can you imagine the kind of confusion Moses would have experienced, raised in a household where he had all the privileges and all of the success, but at the same time recognizing that he was a part of a minority culture that was constantly being put down and dehumanized? Which side are you on? Who are you really? Where is your culture? Who do you represent and who do you stand for? And so before we get to the burning bush, Moses has several defining moments as an adult where he's forced to choose. The first one we've all heard about. It may be very familiar to you. Did you hear that Moses killed an Egyptian long before he fled into the wilderness? There was a point where the Hebrews had been enslaved. And he comes across two people fighting. One is an Egyptian, and one is a Hebrew slave. And the Egyptian is just beating him up. He's just beating him up. And in that moment, Moses decides to take action. And this is really critical, because when he saw this, he could have pretended he didn't see it. He could have walked on by and said, "This is somebody else's problem. I don't need to get involved in this. This doesn't concern me. This doesn't affect me." He had to do several really important things. He had to say, "I see this and I acknowledge this. This is definitely a problem. And there's no one else around," because he looked to see if there's anyone else around and no one else was around, which meant that it was up to him to stop it. And if he didn't, it would be on his head that it wasn't stopped. And so he jumped in and he defended the Hebrew who was being beaten up. And in the process, he killed the Egyptian. And then he tried to bury the body and pretend like it didn't happen, because he could have gotten into a lot of trouble for that. But he took a stand. He took a stand. And then a couple days later, he's wandering around. He's just taking a walk and he sees two Hebrews fighting. And it's clear that one is definitely being the aggressor and he's in the wrong. So Moses, again, makes a choice. He could say, "This does not concern me. This is not my problem. This doesn't affect me. I have a nice, safe castle that I can go back to with plenty of food, plenty of water, totally safe. I don't have to intervene." But he does anyway. And he goes to the one who's being the aggressor and says, "Why are you doing this? You're clearly in the wrong." And he takes a stand and he tells the truth and he holds someone accountable. And you know what they say to him? "What, are you going to kill me just like you killed the Egyptian?" And he realizes that word has gotten out, that he takes a stand. And Pharaoh has found out about this, so he can't go home anymore. And isn't it interesting that in the process of looking at this situation, people see him as the aggressor and Pharaoh sees him as the one that's at fault. They don't see him as a freedom fighter. They see him as an insurrectionist, as an aggressor. Isn't that interesting? But he takes a stand anyway. And then, because he knows Pharaoh was after him, and there's a bounty on his head at this point, he runs. He takes off out of Egypt, and he runs into the wilderness. And he comes upon a well in the middle of the desert. These existed. People would, the nomads would walk their flocks around and travel with their herds, and then there would be wells that they would all come to get water for their family and for themselves and to water their flocks. And a well in the desert is a life-giving source. Without it, the entire livelihood would die. The flocks would die, and the families would die. And so there's this well there. And we have another situation where there are seven daughters of the priest of Midian, seven daughters that are all tending the flocks, right? Which is interesting, because normally we think of the shepherds as being men, but there's seven daughters that are doing this. And they come to the well to get the water for themselves, for their family, and to go back to water the herds with it. And something happens. There are a bunch of male shepherds that are at the well that tell them they're not allowed to use that water. They just say, "No, you can't use it. Go away." They don't have rights to this water. They just prevent them from using it. And again, we see Moses taking a stand, He sees this dynamic, he sees this problem, and he jumps in and he defends the women, and he chases off the shepherds that are trying to prevent them from using the well, and word gets out again. Word gets out again. And in every single one of these situations, Moses is being forced to acknowledge a problem that exists, decide whose side he's on, and then act on it, which is huge. That's not common. That's not usual. Most people in today's society, when they see a situation like this, they would walk on by. I've known people who say, that's not my problem. That's not your problem. I used to know a man who wouldn't give change to people who were panhandling. Which was fine, but if I tried to put change in the cup, he would physically try to stop me. No, you don't need to give change for that. They're just going to use it on drugs. That's not your problem. That is the norm. So Moses has already distinguished himself by being willing to see the problem, acknowledge the problem, act on the problem, always taking the side of the weakest and the most vulnerable. So this church has a history of taking a stand on different issues. For example, Marin has a terrible homelessness problem. San Rafael especially, because there are no permanent shelters for homeless in San Rafael. And housing prices are so high that no one can afford to live here. Unless you got in and bought your house like 30 years ago, it's very difficult for people to come in and purchase a new home unless you're exceedingly wealthy. And this church has tried to tackle that problem in different ways. First of all, by helping with support the Ritter Center and by helping support Homeward Bound, by building Pilgrim Park, which is low-income housing, affordable housing, right next door. The church, for those that don't know, donated the land, founded the board, got the government funding, and built the housing. And we also participate in the Rest Shelter Dinner Program by bringing meals to the rotating shelter, it's not permanent, that occurs in San Rafael. And yet there are still homeless in this area. And there is no place for them to go. I wonder how many of them are pregnant and how many of them are named Joe and Maria. So God reaches out to Moses. Moses is walking around one day, and all of a sudden, when he's out with the flocks, he ended up marrying one of those daughters, by the way, one of the shepherdesses that had been driven from the well. He marries one of them, so he's tending the flocks for his father-in-law now. And he's out and about. And as he's going by, he sees out of the corner of his eye this gigantic burning bush, which is weird because, you know, fires happen, but this one is being burned but not consumed. And again, he makes a choice. He could say, that's a little weird, I think I'm going to walk away. But instead, he decides to take a chance to go check it out. And when he is noticing it and looking at this, he hears God call him by name. And again, he could ignore it, but he chooses not to. And then we get to the real heart of the issue here, where God calls him and says, I have heard my people crying out. I have remembered the covenant that I made with my people. And I'm going to ask you to stand up to Pharaoh and lead my people out of slavery into freedom. Will you do it? And Moses says, why me? Well, why not him? Why not him? He's already demonstrated multiple times that he's willing to take a stand. The only thing was he had to do it on an individual basis. At this point, he's starting to realize that there is a reason why Egyptians are allowed to beat up on Hebrews. And there is no accountability there. He's starting to realize that there is a reason why Pharaoh's allowed to enslave an entire population and nobody holds him accountable. And there's a reason why men are able to say, this is our well, you can't touch it, and women just have to live with it. He's starting to realize that there is a much larger systemic problem that needs to be addressed on a much larger national scale that cannot be addressed with just one single incident at a time. And so he has to come a little further. He's already been wrestling with who he is, but he hasn't settled on it yet. And so when God and Moses have this conversation that we heard today, we hear some very interesting back and forth. And we see Moses trying to figure out who he is and who is God and what God's larger plan is. The first question he asks is, why me? Why should you choose just little old me? How am I not worthy? And that's a really critical, how am I worthy to do this? And that's a really critical question, because when God calls him and when God talks to him, he makes it very clear. You are a child of God, and you are part of a covenant that extends back thousands of years. A covenant that says, you will be my people, and I will love you unconditionally and help the most vulnerable no matter what. That is who you are. You are part of something much larger. And the other question in here that he asks is, and if I should go to Pharaoh and if I should go to the people and say, God calls you out of Egypt, who am I supposed to say you are? Which is a very simple question phrased in a very, very, very wild and woolly way. Who is God? And that's a really important question, because it guides everything that Moses does next. Who is God? And when God responds, he says, this is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, which calls to mind all of those stories and all of that history, that this is a God who has acted throughout history on behalf of the Hebrew, the refugee, the God who helps the most oppressed, the God who saves the innocent children like Isaac from harm, the God who makes old women like Sarah, Abraham's wife, fertile again, the God who acts to save entire countries like the nation of Egypt through Jacob from starvation, the God of Noah, of the covenant, who will not tolerate human beings being violent and wicked towards one another, but who gives clean slates and fresh starts to all who are willing to turn towards God, and who covenants with humanity to love them, not harm them. In that simple phrase, I am, and I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, Moses is reminded of who God is. And finally, Moses says, but I can't do this all by myself. And the reality is, he hasn't been doing it all by himself. He already had help from the midwives who refused to harm the baby boys. He already had help from his mother who put him in a basket. He already had help. God already sent him, Pharaoh's daughter, to pull him out of the water and raise him. Moses already had help from his father-in-law who brought him in out of the desert after he helped his daughters and fed him and helped him find a wife and gave him a flock to tend. Moses has already been helped. God has already been reaching out to him and sending him helpers. And Moses in that moment realizes what we all have to come to realize when we're confronted by problems in this society that are much larger than us and that are too big for us to solve individually. Moses has to realize that he is simply one small part in God's much larger plan. There are a lot of people that have been working on it before us. There will be a lot of people after us. And there are a lot of people right now that if we look around, we can partner with them. We can see the work that they've already done. We can build on it. And we can do our part to get us a little further towards the just and peaceful society that God is calling us to build. And that's when Moses realizes he's going to be sent Aaron. And he's going to have all sorts of resources from God to help him through this difficult time. So this past week, two very interesting things happened. First of all, I got a call from a woman who lives up in Rohnert Park. She needed help with her rent. Here's the thing. She ran a florist shop. She ran a little florist shop. And then she said the big stores moved in, Walmart and all them. And her florist shop dwindled and dwindled and dwindled and dwindled to the point that she couldn't keep it going anymore. And that is how she ended up needing rent. She also broke her leg, so she had several months that she wasn't able to work. And so she asked for some help paying rent. Well, we know we have a problem in Marin County. We know that we have issues with homelessness. But she was not alone. She said that she had called and called and called every friend that she knew and as many people as she could to try and figure out how she was going to make her rent this month so she wouldn't be thrown out of her trailer park. And fortunately, I have the pastor's discretionary fund, which you all contribute to. that I can use for situations like this. And there was enough money in the fund to be able to pay about half of her rent, which is what she needed after she had pulled together everything she had. But I also got a call from a person down on Merrydale Boulevard. They showed up. She just showed up and said, can I talk to you? Here's the thing, she says. Some new people bought all of the housing that's down on Merrydale Road. And they threw a fresh coat of paint on these old buildings that are falling apart and then started raising the rents like crazy. And for some of the people in Section 8 housing, they've got a little bit of a buffer, but the rates still went up. And for a lot of the people that have been there, living there for years, that are on Social Security, that have fixed incomes, that are older and cannot work, these rents have become unsustainable. They raised them $500 overnight. And she came to me and she said, here's what we need. We're not asking for money. What we're asking for is a place to meet. That's all we want, is just a place to meet. Me and some of the other tenants are trying to organize to see if we can figure out a way to deal with this. The Marin supervisor said they might be able to buy one of the buildings, but we need some sort of cohesion so that we can fight back against the landlords that are going to raise the rent so high we'll all be out on the street. Will you help us? And I said, well, yeah, sure. We got to talk to the Board of Trustees, but I'm sure we could provide you a space. And are you aware of the Marin Organizing Committee? You know, this organization that our church helped found that's been fighting for permanent housing. And we have these other resources. And she had not heard of any of this. And she almost looked like she was going to cry. And she said, you know, I have called other churches and they all told me no. I'm not going to name the churches because they're our neighbors. She said, she called one church and they said, no, go away. Of course we're not going to help you with that. Why would we help you with that? She called another church, and they put her off and put her off and put her off and put her off, and then finally said, we can't help you. Please stop calling. And she called me, and I said, well, maybe this is the burning bush. Maybe this is a chance for us to act in faith, to give just a space for someone to meet. Maybe this is that moment where we can say, there is no problem. The problem we've been working on all around Marin County and then all around San Rafael and then downtown when they wanted to close the Ritter Center and then the Rest Shelter Dinner Program, which is over there, because the Rest Shelter Dinner Program now, they're talking about not sustaining it next year. And now it's right here next to us. This problem has been coming closer and closer and closer and closer, and now it's right here on our doorstep. At a certain point, we have to make a choice. And we look to this story to guide us. And it reminds us. It reminds us of who we are and who God is and what the goal is and that we are not alone. We are children of God, part of a covenant that extends back thousands of years. A covenant that says, if we choose to follow God, God will help us, not harm us. And our goal in all of this is to build a just and peaceful society for all people. Our God is the God of the refugee and the innocent, the children and the oppressed, the hungry, the homeless, the forgotten, and the most vulnerable. And we don't have to do it alone. We already have a group of people that are organizing and talking and seeking legal advice and reaching out to the city. All they need is one small part from us, just a place to meet. We can do that. We can do that. God calls us every day to help, but God does not ever send us alone. Can I get an amen to that?